Hello, I'm Casey Watson with KidLink Community Services, here to bring you the Foster Care and Adoption Life Talk podcast, where we'll be talking about foster care, the children in foster care, and how you and the community can make a difference. Hello, I'm Casey Watson.
And I'm Tina Graves.
And welcome back to the KidLink Foster Care and Adoption Life Talk. Today we're going to be discussing why children come into foster care and what that kind of looks like.
We'll talk about some statistics and the reasons that children come into care and why we need you all in the community to help.
So let's start off talking a little bit about what a foster child looks like. Who is it that comes into care? And what immediately comes to mind for me is just some facts to get us started. There's over 9,000 kids just in Tennessee alone in foster care.
And Casey, only half that number of foster families. So we have 9,000 children in care and roughly 4,500 foster families.
And I think that as a general population, if you don't work in this field every single day, you have a picture in your mind of what a foster child looks like. And you think, oh, it's the child that, you know, has been horribly physically abused. Oh, it was the child that was, you know, abandoned and they found them a week later, things like that. But really, the majority of our children in foster care are in foster care simply for neglect. I guess about 90% of the children in foster care are in care for neglect.
Right. And that neglect looks very different. It can be medical neglect, educational neglect, multiple things that go on.
Educational neglect, for example, can look like a child who has, you know, a tremendous amount of tardies or absence from the, you know, absence in school, and they will call in DCS to investigate that, and a child can come into custody simply because they weren't in school regularly.
Because they were truant. And then also physical neglect. We have children that's basic needs are not being met, and a lot of times the school also brings that to DCS's attention because these children come in and they're not fed, they're hungry, they're not clothed appropriately depending on the weather. And so DCS again becomes involved.
While we're on this subject, you and I have talked about the medical neglect before too and how that's often overlooked. Sometimes it's out of, you know, what we would view as traditional neglect of just not taking care of the child's needs. And many times these children have issues, health issues, diagnoses that are very difficult to care for, and the parents are simply unable to meet the child's needs.
Or unknowing of how to meet those needs. They don't know what the community, what's in the community to help these children and to help them learn to parent these children. So those services, there's services in the community for all of these instances of neglect, but it's a lack of knowledge and people not knowing how to get their child the help that they need.
And then, of course, we do have the traditional, I'd say, for lack of a better term, abuse that is stereotypical of what people think of children in foster care. And that looks a lot of different ways as well. It can be physical, it can be sexual, it can be emotional.
Absolutely. I would say that the majority of that 10% is probably physical abuse. And whether it be a parent's unknowing of what appropriate discipline is, discipline can go too far. Discipline should be a teaching tool, not a punishment.
And then, you know, when you're talking about sexual abuse, that is something I think that has been swept under the rug or just makes people uncomfortable to talk about. So it's not been addressed appropriately in the public, I don't think. And if you talk about sexual abuse, that can look a lot of different ways as well. If you have your what people think of as sexual abuse as a child being molested or a child being, you know, raped. But sexual abuse can simply be a child in a room where other sexually inappropriate things are occurring. So sort of secondhand sexual abuse.
Yeah, or just exposure to pornographic material. It can, like you said, with the computer and the internet these days, sexual abuse can look a lot different.
And we see a lot of sexual abuse, you know, from predators, and which is a whole nother thing. And that's not something that's per se going to put the child in custody if the parents unknowingly, you know, did not know that was occurring. However, it does bring another aspect to parenting that for foster parents and for biological parents, as far as all the different protections that you have to put on children's devices and just their environment, because technology has made it so that it's so easy for sexual abuse to occur.
Absolutely.
And then we have emotional abuse. Tina and I have had this discussion lots of times that for us, that's more difficult than the physical abuse, because that's what you can't see.
You can't see it, and children can't explain it. There's not those bruises to look at. There's not the physical exams that can be done that let us know sexual abuse is happening. But emotional abuse is mental, and whether it be putting a child down, nothing is ever good enough, whatever the case may be, emotional abuse is much harder to see and harder to diagnose, but can have the most tremendous effects.
And would you say, I'm thinking about just emotional abuse in general, that a lot of it is generational. And so a lot of children are living in homes maybe where that's being modeled or being, is happening to maybe the other adults in the home, between parents, between, adult siblings, and they see it and it's unnoticed because they don't recognize that as being not normal.
Right. It is their norm. And I think that's what's so hard for some people to see, is this is their norm. And just because it's not society's norm, it's normal for these children and it's normal for these parents. And yes, I think it's very much a vicious cycle and uneducation.
Yes, and which is one of the things that I think that Tennessee has done a good job in the last few years. And for instance, with our foster parents alone, they used to take a very extensive foster care training program, but it was focusing more on the logistics of foster care, more on the, this is how we do things. These are the things you're responsible for. This is how we handle meetings. This is how we handle situations. And then Tennessee was one of the states that kind of pioneered needing a shift.
Absolutely. They shifted from that traditional foster parent training to more of a trauma-focused training, because all of these children have trauma in their lives.
Right. And Tina and I, we teach this class, and we laugh every time because throughout the class there are several examples where we say, don't do this. We did this, but you don't do this. And it's things we've learned just by teaching the class and by, being in the field that we're in, that, the simplest things that might be triggers for children are different ways to handle things. And so the children in foster care, I guess one of the other important things I want to say is they're more similar to the children that aren't in foster care than not.
Yes, we have. We've had that discussion many times. And just talking about the way that we raised our own children and the mistakes that we made. And all parents are going to make mistakes. The difference is recognizing those and trying to make a difference, trying to make it better.
Right, and also, as parents, and we screw up. I know I've screwed up several times. By the grace of God, my children are where they are today.
Absolutely. Mine as well.
But I think that learning from those mistakes, and your children seeing you learning from those mistakes, because they can get a picture of their parents, that their parents are perfect, that their parents don't make any mistakes. And so when some of these things happen, this physical, sexual, emotional abuse, they're the last ones that want to admit or disclose that their family is doing this to them, because their parents are always right.
Absolutely. And, and I think, Casey, it's really important that we recognize also some of these families are in these situations simply because, as I'd said earlier, the lack of education, but also the lack of support systems. We all have support systems within our own immediate family or extended friends, and there are those families that are just isolated, and they have no one to turn to. They don't have anyone to ask those questions or to bounce things off of. And being a parent can be overwhelming. We all know that, between trying to make a living and doing all the things that we as humans have to do. Being a parent is overwhelming, and when you don't have anybody to support you, it even makes it harder.
And I think it's more and more common now, because families look less and less traditional per se than they used to. Many years ago it was common for four generations to live in one community.
Absolutely.
You know, and then like within my own family, we're spread out across three states. And I have the moral support, the phone support, but I don't have the, you know, go stay with grandma, I need a break.
Absolutely.
I didn't have that. And that lack of support really causes emotional strain in these families and can lead to some of these forms of abuse.
Yes, they can. We all get, like I said, overwhelmed. And it's hard when you don't have that support system. A lot of us have friends that we can depend on and lean on as well if family isn't close by. But some people don't have anyone.
And then to, you know, expound on the isolation and the lack of support system, then came along, I call it the C word, COVID. And it really turned the system upside down.
Oh, it has. And our numbers of children in foster care have risen because of that. More people are working remotely. More people are in the home. More people are unemployed. And it's just created a monster, so to speak, for the welfare system.
And, you know, the welfare system was no different than the rest of the world. We didn't know this was going to happen. We didn't know it was going to hit when it hit. And so there was a lot of learning as we go throughout that whole process, too. And what do we do when there's a child in foster care and a parent's diagnosed with COVID? What do we do when one of the children is diagnosed with COVID? And it's been a learning curve within the system to keep everyone safe and to keep everyone, the foster children, as stable as possible, to not have them moving from home to home. And, you know, then we have, you combine that with the fact that foster parents are rightfully afraid. But, you know, we know a little bit more about it now. We have some preventative measures in place. But prior to that, it was, you know, I'm scared. So how am I going to deal with strangers coming into my home? And what if they're sick?
Oh, for sure. I mean, we have folks that didn't even visit their own family. So, I mean, why are they going to, like you said, invite a stranger into their home to become a foster parent? So as we watch the numbers of children coming into foster care rise, we have, on the other hand, watched our foster families' numbers decline. And it has become a really difficult situation for these children that need help. They need those supports wrapped around them, and we need communities to get involved. So, you know, Casey, we've talked about COVID. We've also talked about the numbers of children that have risen. But, you know, we've not touched on the fact that, you know, in Tennessee, there is an opioid epidemic, as well as methamphetamine use. And that within itself, we saw the numbers rise of children that came into care from that. And that's kind of been put on the back burner since the pandemic. So we still have those children coming into care as well.
Right. And I think typically, historically, we saw the metropolitan areas, of course, because there's more children, have more children coming into custody. But with the methamphetamine crisis, we really begin to see rural children coming into custody and a shift from, you know, from their lower numbers to more and more families, you know, falling apart because of this methamphetamine crisis.
Yes. And not only that, but no longer than these issues have been around, although it seems like it's been a long time, we still don't know what the lasting effects of those issues for children are.
Right. And I think that the opioid crisis and methamphetamine have greatly contributed to the amount of, you know, infants that we have coming into custody, because there are all those unknowns, you know, the children that are abandoned at the hospital, you know, many times out of fear from the parents, from repercussions.
Yes.
You know, and lack of care, or their needs are so great when they're born, they're unable to care for them.
They don't know how to be a parent to begin with. And then when you add the issues on top of that, of a child that has been born addicted, it's an even greater issue.
Right. So that kind of brings me to our next topic. When we're talking about these children that come into custody and the parents not necessarily not wanting to parent, but not knowing how and not having the tools. So when we talk a little bit about why kids come into care and then we moved into they're in care.
Yes.
What happens? So this is where we want to discuss what happens to the children in care and how we provide some of those tools that those parents need. So when a child comes into care, they are immediately assessed for their health and their well-being, and DCS begins to search for a placement.
And a lot of times DCS, all of the time, DCS is looking first and foremost for a family member or someone that is close to that child or family that can take care of that child. DCS doesn't want children in foster care. DCS does not want to parent children. DCS wants to be a tool to help families remain together.
Yeah, and just to backtrack a little bit, before it gets to the point where a child is in custody looking for that placement, DCS has been in the home,
working with that family, trying to create a healthy, safe environment for that child to continue to reside.
And they've used, you know, mental health services that they may have. They've used, you know, just community resources if housing's an issue, if, you know, jobs are an issue. And so by the time a child comes into custody, most of those efforts have been either not successful enough, or, you know, the child's safety is still an issue. And so that is how they end up in custody looking for that foster placement.
You know, there's always that emergency situation when a child comes into foster care immediately. But yes, the majority of the time, DCS or other private providers are providing services in that home, trying to keep that child with their family.
And what it looks like when they get into that placement is a whole menu of services begin to take place. We have that initial meeting that happens almost immediately, and it's the team of everyone that's involved in that child's life that has an effect on that child's life. It's parents. It's
family service workers. It's a CASA worker, court-appointed special advocate.
It could be a teacher.
It could be a Sunday school teacher.
Yeah, and so this team, as we call it, is built around this child to really advocate for the child's best needs and interests.
Yes.
And that team comes up with what we call a permanency plan. And at that plan, it's talked about as a team, which I really like that about our system, is that it's not left to one person. It's not a caseworker that's making the decision. It's not, you know, a parent that's making a decision, because as a, you know, a social service worker, I wouldn't want that responsibility of coming up with those plans and carrying them out, you know?
No, I mean, it's a whole array of people that are wrapping their arms around this family and trying to provide services and create a better situation. And not only does that permanency plan focus on what the child needs, that permanency plan also focuses on what the parents need.
Yeah, and that plan is spelled out very clearly. I like the way that we do the plans, because we always focus on the strengths.
Yes, it is definitely a strengths-based permanency plan.
And not just the strengths of the children, but also the strengths of the parents.
And it's probably one of the first times that these parents have ever heard their strengths. You know, they, depending on their background, they could have come from a place that they've never been told anything was good enough. So they just quit trying.
And you look at some of the parents and maybe some of the tragedies that they've been through or the abuse that they've endured, and you see them and you think, you know, stereotypically, well, gosh, what strengths are they going to have? But, you know, one of the things that always comes to my mind when I see a mom that has endured and showing up for the meeting even after her child is in custody is she's resilient.
Yes.
And she's doing her best to bounce back. And so DCS and KidLink keep that in mind, and we come up with a plan that provides them the help that they need. And many of them, it's accountability. They've never been accountable before, had anyone to be accountable to.
Accountability as well as trauma. So many of these parents have experienced trauma that has not been diagnosed or dealt with itself. So how can you parent a child that has issues if you've not dealt with your own?
Exactly. And so what we're trying to do during this process is put services in place for the child, which can look like therapy, many kinds of therapy. If it's grief and loss therapy, if they've lost a parent, you know, to a tragedy, if it's, you know, or just being displaced from their family, if it's some anger management, you know, a teenager that has some anger issues that we need to work through, trauma, if there's been abuse, you know, and we really, you know, far reach into the community for the best resources for this child. And while they're getting their work done, then we're working with the parent to get their work done. You know, we're reaching into the community to set them up with parenting classes or assessments if they need drug and alcohol assessments or treatment, and work on that. And all the time that those things are happening separately, we're still trying to have some concurrent contact with them if it's healthy for the child.
Yes. We always try to keep parents and children connected, whether it be via phone calls, visits, whatever the case may be. If it's a safe environment, we do not want to sever that relationship.
And we work really hard with the foster parents that we work with at KidLink as well to drive home that how important it is for them to be a bridge with that family.
A partner.
And, you know, and DCS does that as well in their training that the foster parents go through. It's very important that everyone stays on that same team. We don't ever want to get to a situation where we're sitting at the table and it's DCS versus KidLink versus foster parent versus biological parent. We all need to be on the same page.
Yes, we do. And a lot of times, when that foster parent becomes a partner with that birth parent, it's the first support that birth parent has ever had. And the team can be the first support that the birth parent has ever had. DCS does a really good job of going into these situations without pointing the finger. And like you said, a strength-based approach, but saying, what do you need? What can we help you with? It's not only about the child. It's about keeping this family intact.
Right. And as we go through the process with the children in custody, we don't, you know, leave it open-ended as, you know, we don't know when you're going to go home or we don't know if you'll ever go home. The team meets regularly every quarter and they assess where they are with the plan, who's doing what they're supposed to be doing. If they're not, you know, if someone slipped up and not done something, why did that occur? If it occurred and there was a barrier that we can help with, we try to work out, you know, a solution to that barrier. But all along, we make sure that the child knows that ultimately we're working to get them back with their family.
Yeah, especially if the child is older. That child is part of that process, that teaming process and permanency planning process.
So we have this great system in place on paper. We have a protocol when they come into custody. We know how we're going to assess them. We know how to, you know, come up with the plan and have that follow-up.
Yes, we have all our team members in place and looking for therapies and looking for those community services.
We have all this, like you're saying, we have this team in place. But what we need now are the foster parents, because the foster parents are the backbone that are going to make all of this work. And foster parents, you know, have to come to the table. I say come to the table with open hands, because it's a tough road, but they can receive just as much as they give.
Yeah, it's hard to open your heart to these children knowing that one day they're going to go back home. But just because they go back home, depending on how things have gone, and depending on the partnership that you've had, that foster parents have had with that birth family, it's not a connection that has to be broken for that child.
No, and as we're sitting here talking, I have several foster parents that come to mind that still have very strong relationships with children that they've had in their home. And not only with the children, but with their parents.
Yes, and those children still come back and visit.
Yeah, and, you know, one in particular I know has the children regularly just to give the parents a break because they didn't have that support. And she became the foster parent, but then ultimately a support system for those parents and that family.
Yeah, surrogate family.
Exactly. And then also, as we're talking about foster parents, they're charged with such a task of children that they don't really know coming into their home, nurturing them, loving them, you know, all along making sure that therapeutically they're moving in the right direction, that we also want to make sure that we take care of our foster parents.
Yeah, and that's the reason, I mean, we have respite and things like that in place so that these foster parents have a break. Because we know it's not only is it physically taxing, it can be mentally taxing. Because some of these children do have some behaviors and some trauma that they've dealt with that's hard for foster parents to deal with. But we also want to be that support for foster parents.
And if you think about foster parents, you know, they look a lot of ways, but two ways come to mind. And one is the couple that doesn't have children of their own.
Or the couple that have children that are grown.
Yes.
And have that empty nest syndrome.
And you think about how when you were when you were having that biological child, how all the months you had to prepare, and the, you know, the showers that were given to give you the things that you need, and the, you know, the books you could read, you know, what to expect when you're expecting and what to expect the first year. So really, if you're having a child, you go into it over prepared many times. And then these same parents, we're dropping off a 7-year-old
within 30 minutes of a phone call.
Yeah, so just to imagine what that shift is, to be from we don't have any children to now we have a 7-year-old with trauma.
And what that looks like and how to deal with that.
And so we really try to wrap around our foster parents with support with it, with each other within their own network, support with our workers. I know, like with KidLink, for instance, our workers are checking on their children almost daily.
Yes. Phone calls, text messages, whatever the case may be. And by no means are we trying to make foster parenting sound like a bad thing or like it's this scary thing. Foster parents are something that we need desperately and that these children need desperately. I mean, we have children coming into foster care and having to sleep in DCS offices because we don't have enough foster homes to place them. But at the same point in time, we want to be real. We don't want to sugarcoat things and people not realize what they're getting into. It can be very heartbreaking when you have had a child in your home for 6 months, 8 months, whatever the case may be, and you've quote unquote fallen in love with that child and then to watch them leave. But the happiness is in that success of when that child goes back home and you know you've been a part of that success.
Absolutely. And also the other part of that is the child that's in your home for 4 or 5 years, because you know, it looks like they're not going to be able to return home. But the court system, you know, it takes a while to get through and they have to exhaust every effort. And so that foster parent that just sticks in there with that child until they can become their forever home and doesn't give up on them or the system.
Yes. Or that foster parent, that child, foster child that has left that foster home but still comes back on holidays or birthdays to visit. And it's that knowledge of knowing that in some way you have made a major difference in a child's life and you have helped them in a great way and to become a more successful adult.
Yeah, and as we're talking about the holidays, that season, you know, has recently passed. And during the holidays, we look for, you know, these children not to be sleeping in offices, to be in a home with their children, with the family and other children, if possible. And so foster parents sometimes is just that. It's that moment of normal and that moment of family that they wouldn't get to experience otherwise.
Yes. And so many of our children in foster care spend the holidays alone or in other situations that are possibly not the best for them. And foster parents do bridge that gap and help that normal.
Right. And so as we start the new year, I know that, you know, everyone makes resolutions. You know, I'm going to do this year. I'm going to do that. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to exercise, whatever it might be. I guess Tina and I, you know, our resolution is how many foster parents can we get? How many homes can we open? And that's our resolution, to open as many homes as we can so these children don't have to sleep in an office. They don't have to, you know, to wonder where they're going to be that night.
And I think just to piggyback off that is also to bring about the community awareness. You said earlier, Casey, that child abuse, primarily sexual abuse, was what you had referenced, had been swept under the rug for years. But I think that children in the foster care system have been swept under the rug for years. I don't think that people really want to know that that is occurring. They stay in their own perfect little life, and they don't want to think about the misfortune of others. But this is happening in our communities, and these are the children that are going to be part of this next generation that is running this country, so to speak, or the population of this country. And we want to make sure that they're helped as much as they possibly can be.
Oh, yes. And I think that right now, our immediate need, as I'm just thinking through what our needs are in the community, is for people to be educated.
Yes.
You know, and there's no place you and I won't go to talk about foster care.
Anywhere people are willing to listen.
Yes. And there's really no time that we won't go. We'll make it work with our schedule. We've done some crazy times. We've done some crazy events and shown up to talk about foster care and these kids and what we need from the community.
Right. And I think one thing that has changed a lot over the last several years is the partnership that we now have with churches and trying to get that message out, and the responsibility of church congregations to assist these children. So we would definitely like to come and speak to your congregation.
Yes, and congregations of any denomination or religion, or, you know, they're really the founding fathers of support and family and small groups and the wraparound. And so, you know, in many ways we model that, or we attempt to model that with our foster families. And so it's a perfect marriage when we can work with the church or a congregation, because they get the importance of that teamwork and that wraparound love.
And not only that, but a child doesn't only get a foster home if it's someone out of the congregation. They get a whole church family.
This is our first podcast. We were rookies today.
And we got through it, I think, okay?
And we did. And so, you know, there's nowhere to go but up. So we hope that you guys will tune in again. We're going to tackle some more difficult topics around the child welfare system and have some guests come in to maybe give you different perspectives on their role in the system. So if you would like more information on foster care or KidLink, we are always around and willing to provide you whatever we can.
Sure, reach out to us. Our number is 877-714-1313, or you can always visit our website at kidlinkservices.com. So please like, subscribe, share with a friend, leave a review, our podcast.
And most importantly, tune in next week. Thank you for listening to this episode of KidLink Foster Care and Adoption Life Talk, where we focus on linking kids and families to hope, healing, and trust. If you're interested in becoming a foster parent or learning more about KidLink, visit our website at kidlinkservices.com.